In 4, 3, 2, 1. Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Authority Smashing Hour with your host, Luke Kim, and Mr. 1001 Nights. Join us as we embark on a journey through radical news and politics, take calls, and get you ready to engage in the struggle against capitalism.
Viva la Quinta Brigada, la rumba, la rumba, la rumba. Viva la Quinta Brigada, la rumba, la rumba, la rumba. Que nos cubrirá de gloria, ay Carmela, ay Carmela. Que nos cubrirá de gloria, ay Carmela, ay Carmela. Luchamos contra los moros, rumba la rumba la rumba la la. Luchamos contra los moros, rumba la rumba la rumba la la. Mercenarios y fascistas, ay Carmela, ay Carmela. Mercenarios y fascistas, ay Carmela, ay Carmela. Ejército del Ebro, rumba la rumba la rumba la la. El ejército del Ebro, rumba la rumba la rumba la la. La otra noche el río cruzó, ay Carmela, ay Carmela. La otra noche el río cruzó, ay Carmela, ay Carmela. Y a las fuerzas invasoras, rumba la rumba la rumba la. Y a las fuerzas invasoras, rumba la rumba la rumba la. Buena paliza le dio, ay Carmela, ay Carmela. Buena paliza le dio, ay Carmela, ay Carmela. Los frentes de Granada, rumba la rumba la rumba la. En los frentes de Granada, rumba la rumba la rumba la. No tenemos días lunes, ay Carmela, ay Carmela. No tenemos días lunes, ay Carmela, ay Carmela. Y tenemos días martes, rumba la rumba la rumba la la. Y tenemos días martes, rumba la rumba la rumba la la. Con los tanques y granadas, ay Carmela, ay Carmela. Con los tanques y granadas, ay Carmela, ay Carmela.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Authority Smashing Hour, the best anarchist show on the net. That was Ay Carmela, a song from the Spanish Civil War, a war that was won by the fascists, but which nevertheless allowed a lot of future anarchists to look back with pride and with hope, some real hope, not the kind of hope that we've seen on the campaign trail of Mr. Barack Obama. I'm sure you would agree with that. Joey, you over there?
Yeah,
there?
No doubt. No doubt. We got to get people off the hopium.
That's right.
We need to kick the hopium habit in this country.
Right. So, yeah, I guess a lot of stuff happening in the world. Have you kept up with news this past week, Joey?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of stuff we can talk about. I think it'd be cool to follow up on our earlier discussions of the G20 last, you know, a few weeks or so, to think about the IMF, the resistance to the IMF that we've been seeing around the world lately, over the past week or so. And then there's all sorts of interesting stuff happening in the Greek insurrection, relating to our relationship to the socialists that just gained power in Greece. So
right.
Those are two interesting moments.
I wonder what the analysis of that is, that, you know, the socialists gained power, and apparently it had to do with some discontent in the country with the right wing, which, I mean, they said it was the economic crisis, and they blamed it on the right. Although in Spain, for example, you know, the so-called socialists there, the Socialist Party is in power, and they're blaming it for the economic crisis. But I don't know if the policies followed by the right are all that much worse than those of the so-called left. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think basically whenever you see a downturn in the economy, whoever's in power in whatever country it is going to get the blame, you know, rightfully or wrongly. So it makes no difference if people are going to take their ire out on those in power. And given that our current political situation around the world is set up on a, you know, liberal conservative left right type of binary, you know, the people of each of these countries that are subject to, you know, the whims of global capital are going to blame whichever, you know, pole of, you know, global capital is in power. So, you know, if it's
right,
liberal, the liberals are going to get the blame, and if it's conservatives, then conservatives are going to get the blame. And
I'm wondering,
you know,
though,
all the while, both sides are going to stop, you know, anybody from really interrogating the system. You know what I mean?
I'm wondering, though, if this anarchist movement in Greece, which we all know is pretty awesome, actually had a role in pushing the government to the left.
Oh, it certainly did. We got to remember, Greece has a long history of very vibrant radicalism, and it has to do with really sort of the pendulum swinging far right, far left in Greece, you know, for a long time now, going, you know, to World War II and before. So yeah, it's got a lot to do with the anarchists. I mean, we trace this current situation back to December of 08, when the Greek police basically killed a little anarchist kid. I think he was 15 or 16 years old, and that touched off, like, you know, weeks of riots in Greece. So yeah, basically that situation really has been bubbling ever since. And that also had, you know, that also coincided with the real sort of nadir of the latest global collapse, global crisis.
Right, so, it all happened at the same time.
The anarchists were really sort of, as usual, we're out at the fore, you know, with our critiques and our confrontations with capital and with power, and we played a huge role, we meaning, you know, the anarchists in Greece, played a huge role in facilitating the downfall of the conservative government, and lent a lot of militancy to the discontent with the conservative government, to the point where it ended up toppling. And now the situation we see in Greece is that the socialists have taken power. They won the last election within the last couple of weeks, and they have since turned on. Familiar story, of course, but like they've turned on the anarchists and have really sort of hit Exarchia hard, which Exarchia is like a suburb, a borough, I guess, of Athens.
Right, right.
That's a really hardcore anarchist enclave, and they've, you know, hit Exarchia really hard and cracked down on the anarchists that are basically running that part of the city. From my understanding, Exarchia is essentially like a police-free zone. It's, you know, it's pretty much run in that sense by the anarchists. And wow, so yeah. So they crack down, you know, in turn, just like basically the fascists, the parastate fascists have been doing, you know, since about February, March of this year, in reaction to the uprising. So here we have the socialists who get empowered, declaring themselves the true anti-authoritarians, you know,
well,
taking
yeah.
their jackbooted selves down into Exarchia, cracking skulls, and arresting, you know, arresting
well,
anarchists.
Well, we think we know what that's about. But anyway, to change subject a little bit, you sent me some other links that I found interesting about IMF protests and loan stipulations. And it's kind of interesting that a lot of these riots are happening in Eastern Europe, which were the sort of former Soviet satellites, which the U.S.-led corporate capitalist bloc was extremely happy to conquer. It's now become, you know, that part of the world has become sort of the switch-up capital of Eastern Europe. It's extremely extremely harsh down there, and and all the former members of the Politburo became, you know, rich bankers and capitalists and stuff, and foreign corporations are making a killing. But you have some protests now. Here it says that a lot of Romanian public sector workers were on strike, and because of IMF mandated pay cuts, and so, you know, you have hospitals throughout the country dealt only with emergencies, while teachers supervise children without conducting lessons in Romania's most wide-ranging protest since the fall of communism in 1989. So that's pretty significant, don't you think?
Oh, I definitely think so. I think that the Eastern Europeans are getting, have gotten, anyways, a nice little taste of neoliberalism, and I don't think they find it very palatable. And it's not just Eastern Europeans. Turkey, the IMF had a meeting in Turkey as well, and there were, you know, there were riots there, which you wouldn't necessarily think, like Turkey wouldn't necessarily associate with like hardcore anti-capitalist, anti-globalist sentiment, but there you have it. You know, and Iceland as well is resisting the IMF. So
uh-huh.
I think these Eastern European countries, you know, they're getting a taste of something, and it's not very yummy for them.
Well, Iceland is a richer country, but it went through a pretty tough crisis during the, like, last year, because they had a huge percentage of their economy in these subprime loan mortgages. And they really collapsed. I mean, the whole financial system was on the verge of disaster. So, you know, I don't know if they're. Oh yeah, they have. You know, they have a sort of coalition there of different parties in Iceland. Not too sure about that. But you know, it's interesting in this context that, you know, we always, it's sort of like a cliche of the corporate media and the intellectual culture, that we have to choose. It's either we let these capitalists run our lives, these corporations, these banks, or we let the communist dictators run our life. It's sort of like they always make that sort of like false dichotomy. And of course, capitalism is on the side of freedom, and then the communist dictators are on the side of slavery and oppression. You know, it's kind of a funny. It's like, in some sense, it's like, you know, one of the only weapons they have in terms of rejecting radical ideas. It's sort of like, it's always like, well, is it going to lead to this horrible dictatorship? And of course, we know we have freedom under this system. It's just we got to tweak a few things here and there. But Man, it's like, don't you feel that we have to over and over repeat the same tired old stories about how, you know, it's not that we have to choose between these two oppressive forms of government?
Yeah, I think we do. I think it's incumbent upon us to constantly remind people that, you know, there are alternatives to, you know, to the two paradigms that, you know, pretty much everybody has grown up under in the world. So yeah, we do have to do a better job of presenting the alternative, you know, both, you know, in a sort of discursive way, also in a demonstrable way. So
yeah,
it's one of those, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, people are presented with this binary, and it's our job to shatter the binary and say, no, wait a second, we can organize things, we can construct society on a better ground, on a better foundation. Speaking back to, you know, specifically the IMF issue and the Greek issue, this unrest is the direct product of the failures and collapse of global capitalism. You know, I mean, it's to be expected. Every bit as much as, you know, in 1989, Eastern Europeans, the Poles, the Eastern Germans, et cetera, were raising their fists at their communist overlords, their Soviet overlords. That same exact thing, you know, happens and will continue to happen, you know, for the foreseeable future, as people realize that global capital, globalization, neoliberal economic policies aren't going to leave them any better off. And not only aren't going to leave them any better off, but certainly aren't going to facilitate people being able to determine their own destiny and control their own lives.
Yeah. So what happened in Turkey? I'm actually looking at some of the news here, because they had the IMF protests also in Turkey. And, you know, Turkey's pretty brutal state, so they used a lot of police brutality to crush the protests. But but yeah, it has to do with loan negotiations, and man, the IMF is really sticking it to all these countries. It's pretty fucked up.
Yeah, I think one of the things we have to do is define, and this is a very important part of that overall project of you know, educating people. We have to do a good job of defining exactly sort of what globalization is. You know, lots of people have this idea that globalization, I'd say probably most people in the U.S., have the idea that globalization is a sort of benign influence in a world where it sort of sets up, you know, interconnections between different countries based on trade and economics, et cetera. And that is a very watered down version of what globalization is about. It's similar to, you know, people defending capitalism saying, oh, well, it's just, you know, the individual's control of the mom and pop store, et cetera,
right,
et cetera.
I gave you bananas, you give me potatoes, right?
Exactly. The typical sort of watered down, nonsensical version of capitalism.
Right.
Is you know, sort of repeated when people think about globalization. They think it's just, oh, well, us sort of trading with so-and-so, and isn't it nice that we can get, you know, lettuce in February type of thing, you know, without thinking about all the apparatus, both
right,
within their own countries and internationally, that make that thing happen. And it's those apparatus that define what globalization is, how globalization operates, et cetera. So yeah,
right,
among those are the G20 and the IMF. Yeah, go
right
ahead.
Right, and you know, in fact, Chomsky has said that the very term globalization is sort of expresses that same, like rejection, but of a certain kind of globalization, because he says that, you know, globalization just means international integration, sort of like the old left internationalism, which most on the left are in favor of, and that we should call it corporate globalization because it's more accurate. But yeah, I mean, it's sort of like, I just did a video for YouTube called, you know, trying to find a definition for capitalism. And obviously, if you actually look it up in dictionaries and stuff like that, what they try to do is try to emphasize, well, it's just trading. You know, I give you potatoes, you give me tomatoes. And what I say is like, look, I mean, that happened in the Middle Ages, that happened in the Renaissance, that happened in medieval Europe, that happened in the Roman Empire, Egypt. You know, fruit vendors, somebody who trades a banana for a potato, that's happened for thousands of years. That's not capitalism. Capitalism has to do with the pervasiveness of wage labor as a social relation, you know,
One of the instantiations of that is globalization. So I saw the video, and maybe Charnchi can put the link up in the chat room. I saw the video. I think your definition, like, very closely aligns with Proudhon's definitions of capitalism. And we're talking there going back. I mean, I don't know if you've read much of Proudhon or whatever, but I think your instincts are right on. And he basically defines it as that as well. So I mean, it's interesting how, you know, terminology sort of, and the language itself plays into the overall masking of what's really sort of going on, you know, and that's something that just really intrigues me.
Right, right. So I mean, it's a constant battle for concepts, for definitions. There's a very good essay. I don't know if you read it, Joey. It's called Ideological Hegemony. And if you type Ideological Hegemony on your browser, you'll find it. And it's written by some guy who has a website. He's an anarchist, and he basically just describes all the sort of major features of our ideological control, you know, education, media, double speak, or, you know, or double think, whatever you want to call it, you know, those sort of things. And so we're waging a battle on many fronts. And so,
going back to the idea of hegemony, you know, we can look back to Gramsci, the Italian Marxist, who did a really good job of articulating it, you know, generations ago. Uh-huh. It's really interesting. And yeah, go ahead, Jonathan.
No. I'm a little bit aware of some of the concepts of Gramsci. You know, he talked about the ex-person legitimization. You know, these intellectuals who come up with all these concepts to try to legitimize and try to distract people from the institutional analysis. I mean, a very good example, and actually I did a video about this too, was you know, there was a debate between Michael Moore and Sean Hannity. Sean Hannity was basically telling Michael Moore, well, you know, you should not criticize the system unless you're willing to work toward the solution, which is you give up all the money you have to charity. Now, that, you know, and obviously saying, you know, like, you're a hypocrite or whatever. But the thing is that even if Michael Moore was as rich as Bill Gates, and even if Michael Moore and everyone that's rich gave their money to charity, that's not the solution to capitalism, because capitalism is not about, okay, let's get some charity from the rich here. No, capitalism is about, the criticism of capitalism is about a lack of control over our productive lives. It's not just, okay, let me get some money from the rich or whatever. And you know, I'm sure that you, as a student of medieval Europe, and as someone who has studied history, you have a sort of perspective on how, you know, whether or not charity is enough to satisfy the needs of the poor population. What do you think?
Well, it's never going to deal with the underlying systemic critiques, and so, you're never going to get to a place where you alleviate most people's poverty, most people's indigence through systems of charity. Systems of charity really just sort of fill in the gaps and make at whatever system it is, you know, whether it's feudal or capital, sort of more palatable, easier to endure it. And that's what we have now. I mean, it really makes, it's no surprise to me that Hannity would say, oh, well, we should just, why don't you just give everybody, you know, your money? Why don't you just do that? Because that's how the state responds, okay? That's what the social welfare state is. It's a massive sort of, you know, charity engine. You know?
Right, no, but I think there's a difference because...
And so that... response is there.
I would beg to differ slightly because I mean, if Bill Gates gives out, say, $1 million to somebody, there's no that's not out of democratic sort of compulsion or anything like that. He's doing it purely out of his own. I mean, maybe he wants to have a nice image or whatever. But with the state, if you demand, for example, progressive taxation, that at least can be conceivably the product of some degree of democratic control. Now,
right,
obviously,
but that move is never going to systemically undermine the system. That's a Band-Aid that's sort of being put over the system over and over. That's what I sort of meant by that.
Right.
It's not that. I mean, obviously, when you've got the social welfare state working, the engines of whatever democracy you can say that there are, you know, in whatever country it is, are moving. Whereas, you know, in an instance of charity, you just have like an individual's supposed benevolence. So, yeah, it's different in that sense. I was just talking about the fact that neither one of those things are really, you know, systemic critiques, revisions, etc., of the system itself.
Right. I mean, the very suggestion that, you know, the charity is the solution, and that it's basically just proposing something within the framework in which we're already in.
Exactly.
Accept the exploitation of the capitalist workplace, and then within that framework, allow the capitalist or anybody else to engage in charity, and that is the definition of voluntary. Sort of like we have an involuntary framework, and then we find things on around the edges that we call voluntary, and then we assume that the entire system is voluntary. And that's sort of like I find that so often in the sort of commentary of the ideological managers of society, that it's just like, it's a little frustrating that you have to repeat the same things over and over again. But
I didn't see the interview, and I haven't seen the movie yet, so I don't know what response Michael Moore had. I heard your show yesterday with Charn Chi, and you guys were talking about this a little bit. I'm not sure, you know, how well versed Michael Moore is, and in his, I don't necessarily have much faith in his ability to defend his positions on the fly like that, especially in the face of like a gargoyle like Hannity.
I think my impression is that he defended himself in against certain accusations. He defended himself fairly well, but then when it comes to countering things like the charity thing, which really demand that you challenge the whole system and say, look, the system based on charity presupposes the exploitation and the, you know, of the working class, and you want us to accept that framework and so on. I don't think he was willing to go that far and to actually just point out the some of the more sort of root causes of the exploitation that we see in our society. I think that the being compromised, having sort of like one hand tied, that, because I mean, someone like Hannity doesn't have any hands tied. I mean, they really go all out, and they're pretty ruthless about it. But of course, if you are in that sort of context where it's sort of sound bites, you don't have a lot of time to. If you say things like, well, you know, the fruits of my labor are being stolen by the capitalist class, they're going to ask, well, yeah. Wait a second, I never heard that before. You know, can you explain, can you elaborate? And you don't have time to elaborate because the guy is already throwing something else at you, like, oh, that's Marxist, or, you know, we know what that led to. That led to 100 million people killed in communist countries. I mean, stuff like that, you know, sort of like little cliches that you can just throw, and that way right. You don't have to analyze.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting. I called in to Glenn Beck, last month or so, maybe the month before. And it is something, you know, where you're under the gun, you know, in that sort of situation. So I guess I can see, you know, where he may not have been able to formulate it at the time. But it's definitely a conundrum, you know, how do we sort of convey our ideas even? Like, you know, we started off talking about the fact that we obviously have to. But then, depending on the context, I have to be careful of how we do it. So
right.
He has to balance.
I think that's one of the reasons why Chomsky has such a great appeal. I mean, apart from the fact he's got an excellent mind, is that he has been able to defend radical positions pretty effectively, just by by sheer mastery over language, over ideas, over psychology, over understanding. And so he can. I mean, he in all the debates I've seen, he's been able to. To succeed in countering a lot of the ideas that were put forth by the other side, and even I think he won most of the debates that he engaged in, but that's why I always suggest that people read his works and other people's as well. I mean, just because you're good at sort of like a quick debate doesn't really mean that you're better person or smarter. Some people are just more adept at expressing themselves in a book, or more in a long article. And I mean, that's what complex thought is. If you have to reduce yourself to a few sound bites in order to sound convincing, you're shedding a lot of content away, because life is not a few sound bites. I mean, life is full of complexities, full of contradictions, and that's hard to express in 5 minutes, 10 minutes.
Definitely.
I was gonna say, if you want, we can go on to you want to go to a break, or
we can go to a break. That's fine.
Go to break, and then we continue with some more news. I guess we can. We can play some Tom Morello. That would be a good choice. All right. Be back in a few minutes here.
Here we go. For the fight of the workers who are twisted, tricked, and robbed. For the peasant in Guatemala in a sweatshop got your job. And she can't feed her family for the pennies that she makes. Meanwhile, the crime rate's rising up and down the Great Lakes. Like vegetables left in the field, the signatures smell rotten. And the contracts and the deeds that push the race down to the bottom. They load the rubber bullets, they fire another round. I'm heading to the tear gas. Dig in, man, hold your ground. For Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time. For our brothers and our sisters up and down that picket line. For the unnamed and unnumbered who struggle brave and long. For the union men and women standing up and standing strong. Hey! That's right. No queremos juntos vamos taking off. See, y'all hit them where it hurts and bite the hand that feeds. You might get 1 to 3 or probation and a fine. Well, I know where I'm gonna be. I'm gonna be right on that front line. For Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time. For our brothers and our sisters up and down that picket line. For the unnamed and unnumbered who struggle brave and long. For the union
fine men and women standing up and standing strong. Hey! Now dirty scabs will cross the line while others stand aside and look, but ain't nobody never got nothing that didn't raise a voice and push. Like the steel worker in Ohio, the miner in West Virginia, the teacher in Chicago, janitor in Mississippi. From the sweatshops of L.A. to the fields of Mission Flats, there's a thundercloud exploding, and I'm free at last. Like Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time. Like our brothers and our sisters, up and down that picket line. Like the unnamed and unnumbered, who struggle brave and long. Like the union men and women, standing up and standing strong. Like the unnamed and unnumbered, who struggle brave and long. Like the union men and women, standing up and standing strong.
All right, Tom Morello, we're back from break. I guess we're going to cover a little bit of news here. Well, we have a pretty difficult situation for the U.S. Military in Afghanistan. They they're sending more troops, and of course, right after our dear president got received his Nobel Peace Prize, so they're sending more troops. And in Afghanistan, in Iraq, there's no reduction of troops either, according to the latest news. And in Afghanistan, they're just having troubles with all kinds of issues. You know, there was just this news item about armored vehicles, how they, you know, they're having problems with that, and, you know, the weather, and the, you know, they don't have any sort of like the kind of roads they need to. I mean, they're having a lot of the same problems the Russians had. Just the terrain is so harsh, and the Taliban apparently are now in control of a huge percentage of the country. And so, you know, the American Empire is having a hard time maintaining their grip. And I think I saw another news item talking about how they were trying to pay them off. Say, can we give them money and buy their allegiance? Which, you know, as anyone knows, that's kind of dangerous for any smart empire builder. And yeah, so have you been following that wartime stuff?
Yeah, I sort of have. I mean, I am I'll just come out and say it. I'm a Fox News junkie. So whenever I watch the mainstream news, it's almost always Fox News. And the other night, I think Bill O'Reilly and what's that guy with the mustache? Geraldo. Yeah. So Bill O'Reilly and the mustache got into it about, you know, Afghanistan and what we have to do, and Bill O'Reilly said something that was just utterly striking to me, and the mustache agreed with him. It was that for us to put together a viable government in Afghanistan, they thought that we would have to have the Taliban at the table of such a government, like we did in Iraq with the militias. Now, that to me is like a ridiculous admission, okay, to the utter and complete folly of that entire adventure to begin with. Because the whole reason for attacking Afghanistan and the Taliban specifically to take over the country was to get the Taliban out of power because they were, you know, harboring Al-Qaeda.
Right.
It wasn't just enough to send in, like, the cruise missiles, et cetera, like Clinton did, to blow up the bases.
Actually, you know,
they wanted to, like, topple the Taliban. And here we have, you know, these two, you know, right-wing pundits saying, well, you know, maybe the Taliban should be at the table. I'm like, gosh, well, you guys are just utter morons.
Well, we know what it is that they are, and this is something that I've always talked about, how, you know, in that book, Disciplined Minds, that book that I mentioned a few shows ago, that one talks about how the members of any organization, the intellectual servant, so to speak, they almost unconsciously and reflexively change their opinions depending what their employers and what the elite that controls them wants. And so if it's to their convenience, if it's to their benefit to, say, accept the Taliban into the government, they will sort of shift gears, even if for years they've been talking about how horrible the Taliban were. But, you know, actually, this is sort of consistent. If you look at it historically, it's because right before 9/11, in fact, the U.S. had invited the Taliban and to Washington, as if Michael Moore actually showed in his film Fahrenheit 9/11. And and furthermore, they were provided with loan guarantees. And even when they were invaded, of course, illegally, Bush told them, you know, we'll keep bombing you until you turn over to us people who we suspect were responsible for 9/11, even though we refuse to provide you with any evidence. And it turns out, I think it was about 8 months later, the head of the FBI, Robert Mueller, I think it was in front of Congress, that he said that they didn't have evidence. So, in fact, from the very beginning, it wasn't as if they, you know, in fact, the very invasion of Afghanistan was undertaken with the expectation by their own intelligence agencies that it would increase the threat of terrorism. So the concern for terrorism and all this stuff, it really wasn't at the top of the agenda. This was about, I mean, as we know, the Iraq invasion was sort of the real purpose. And Afghanistan was sort of a pretext or a prelude to the invasion of Iraq. And Michael Moore points this well in his movie when he says that a lot of these troops were shifted over to Iraq very quickly, and the Mujahideen and the people who we call Al Qaeda, which is not even clear how to really define them.
It's ridiculous.
Right, but they were not really a priority. One is almost sort of like inclined to believe that you know the American Empire needs enemies. You know, they need enemies so they can't get rid of the enemies. You know, if you get rid of all the enemies, the Taliban were. It was bound for them to recuperate, to gain back their former status, as because institutionally the U.S. is not really opposed to the Taliban. It's not opposed to their oppression. And by the way, I don't know if you actually heard about this, but Code Pink, you know, the liberal anti-war group, has done some good things. They actually came out in favor of the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan. Can you believe that?
It's not surprising at all. You know, it's one of those. It's a typical sort of thing that happens. You know, every bit as much as the Greek uprising is being stabbed in the back right now by the socialists that the anarchists put in power to begin with. Okay, it's a similar thing with the anti-war movement, anti-globalization movement, with liberal groups like Code Pink. This is what's so frustrating with working with people like this. That you just can't count on them to really develop a vibrant systemic critique. And so, you know, so yeah, when it comes time to really, you know, get everybody together again to put together an anti-war, you know, coalition, protest coalition in the U.S., you know, are we going to be able to count on groups like Code Pink? Well, you know, probably not, because they've drunk the Kool-Aid, so to speak. So
right. I mean,
it's really, you know,
In all fairness, I mean, I would have to say that you know, I think we should work on common issues, and you know, we go to demonstrations together,
sure.
You know, it was really funny because, you know, for a few years I used to go out to Union Square every weekend with a friend and protest the war. I remember that one day Code Pink came, and they were holding a banner, and they asked me, you know, can you hold a banner? And I said okay, and I. But then I realized what the banner said, and it said something like, you know, the war is killing our poor soldiers, or I forget what it was exactly, but it was assuming that you know, we have to stop the war, not because of the Afghan people, but the priority was given to, well, you know, it's costly to ourselves, and the poor soldiers are dying, you know, and you know, it's fine to say the soldiers are dying, but we have to take it in the same context as we would take, say, some Soviet protester saying, you know, our poor Soviet soldiers are dying in Afghanistan. Yes, they were dying. Right. It was a tragedy, but the people who we should really be concerned about, at least, you know, or at least give a primary attention to, is the victims, the Afghani victims, you know,
it's symptomatic of a complete and utter lack of empathy from the perspective of the West upon the colonized people. It's you know, it's one of those things that we see. It's a systemic feature of globalization, just to swing back to what we started our discussion tonight with, where, you know, we in the sort of industrialized, late industrialized North, okay, really don't ultimately in the day give a rat's ass about anybody else, okay? You know, so that's manifested as a symptom in Code Pink's tactics. Now, you know, those tactics, when you say, oh, well, we should bring the troops home because they're dying, blah, 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 there's an effectiveness to that tactic because, you know, they're playing on pretty much the rest of society's complete apathy toward the colonized other.
And the biases that are being pushed by the corporate establishment, which would sort of like emphasize, at best, a selfish criticism, like it's costing us too much, or you know, our poor soldiers are dying, and things like that. I mean, it's not to say that soldiers are not influenced and are partly victims as well. There's no doubt about it. But we have to see what we would have to do is apply the same standards as if we were being attacked by soldiers. It's just that we were being occupied, and a member of your family had been killed by an invading soldier. Now, would you, in that sort of context, say, you know, the war should end because the poor soldiers are dying? No, you would say no. We got invaded by these soldiers. Why should I focus my criticism of the invasion of my country on the well-being or the suffering of these invading soldiers? You know, it's just not the right context.
It's not. It's utterly laughable. It speaks of a complete and utter, you know, disregard for, you know, the other people engaged in the conflict. And it really speaks to how, I mean, for lack of a better term, brainwashed everybody is by the military, media, governmental sort of complex in sort of, you know, what our role around the world is. It's quite ludicrous and laughable to, you know, to suggest such a short-sighted, you know, and non-contextualized critique as one that you find in liberal sort of anti-war groups like Code Pink and others.
Right.
It's not
principled. I mean, I think that's what it is.
Yeah.
But, you know,
it's
I mean,
it's not very rigorous. It's insanely just, it's very frustrating. I'm sorry. I can rant forever.
I have to say that at least certain things are improving under the current liberal paradigm. I just read this news item that Obama just released a suppressed Bush EPA finding that global warming endangers the United States, and says the report, technically known as an endangerment finding, was prepared in 2007 by the But the Bush White House refused to make it public because the administration opposed new government efforts to regulate the gases most scientists see as the major cause of global warming. So at least they released this thing, and so...
I'm far more cynical about stuff like that than I think maybe you are, Jonathan. They released that finding, but for what purpose? It plays into Obama's broader sort of propaganda goals of trying to build up a quote-unquote green economy within this capitalism, basically as an attempt to, you know, save, you know, capitalism through, you know, engineering some sort of, again, sort of green economy. It's a shell game. It's the other half of the same thing that we saw under Bush. So,
right.
Yeah, okay. It's cool, yeah, that they released it, whatever. But I'm more cynical. I see it as just, you know, one more piece of the sort of Al Gore-style, you know, capitalist environmentalism where, yeah, we release it basically to authorize all the crap that we're going to now do, okay, to substantiate the capitalist system and keep it rolling even more, you know, limping along, you know, screwing people over, et cetera, et cetera. So,
and it's funny how they support each other.
They
support each other because see, right now they got us talking about, look, you know, Obama's actually pretty good, but it's sort of like we compare, you know, so the liberals need these right wingers who refuse to even release this study. For them to look good, you see, so it's sort of like they depend on each other for to perpetuate the system, and their joint effort works extremely well.
Well, the other side of that coin is, of course, when some sort of terrorist attack happens, you know, then the conservatives, the neocons, can come around saying, "See, we told you so. We need more military. Blah blah blah." It's basically the same operation from just the other side of the coin, you know. So, like, if there was another terrorist attack, all the neocons would say, "Oh, see what we mean? Blah blah blah. This authorizes Afghanistan, Iraq. Oh, and now it authorizes Iran." You know. So when they leak something like this, the Obama administration is basically just the other side of the coin, you know, of late global capital, you know, trying to extend its influence yet again through more neoliberal policies. And I mean, that's sort of how I see it. And yeah, it might be cynical, but I think it's
accurate. I think it's probably true. I mean, I mentioned a few shows ago how worried I was that, you know, just about the global warming situation, because there are some articles out there in pretty mainstream magazines, like I think it's American Scientist, which paint scenarios like you know, not too long, not too far away, we might have a sort of a trigger effect where we'll get progressively hotter and hotter until the oceans start boiling. I mean, we have some scenarios. I mean, some of those scenarios are not as awful as that, but man, this stuff is like, I mean, we're talking about the survival of our species here. And
honestly, if it's not that big, like I was reading some stuff earlier this week about how it's gotten colder like lately. I don't remember. I'll try to find the link and maybe put it on the blog, but about how they've measured temperatures that might be colder, and they think that this might have to do with solar radiation and ebbs and flows of solar radiation and yada, yada, yada. Even if it's not on the scale of, like, massive global catastrophe, okay, like what you're talking about, environmental degradation, okay, exploitation just goes hand in hand with how capitalism works, especially under, you know, our neoliberal, late global capital system of worldwide global exploitation. It's not just people, it's also places. And so even if it's not as big, and this is basically just my attempt to give a sop to the you know, global warming designer, global warming, you know, global climate change deniers, even if it's not that big, we do know that, well, hell, that factory is polluting your own water. You know, and why? Because you let that factory be there. So, you know, it's it's the same thing, only, you know, same thing that happens to people happens to the environment. And well, that exploitation is the product of us not having a say over our own economic lives.
Right. That's and not allowing the values that would come out in a more participatory environment to basically guide what we do. We let instead right. these autocratic forces that basically draw the more negative tendencies out of our nature. So we get all this greed, all this and you know what's interesting too is that. The very sort of core of capitalist ideology that, you know, we follow our own self-interest and stuff and everything works out great if we all do that. Like, you know, this global extinction is not to our self-interest. So even if we didn't care about all this species that we're destroying, which obviously this is a crime that goes beyond anything done against humans. I mean, when you wipe out a species, that's worse than, say, killing, say, you know, 6 million Jews in gas chambers. You know, the Holocaust, in fact, the Holocaust didn't even kill all the Jews. I mean, the Holocaust does not compare to, say, wiping out all of humanity. But that's exactly what we're talking about when we're talking about wiping out a whole species. And apparently humans have wiped out, you know, maybe thousands, maybe millions of, I don't know how many species, but I certainly know as many. And that, so even if we didn't care about them, if we just cared about us, capitalism is not good for that either, because it's not allowing us to survive.
Yeah, it's a charade. You know, the idea that, you know, we should have control over our own lives, our own economic lives, have a say over what goes on, is what capitalism tries to, you know, convey about itself, but it's not. You know, if people did have that sort of a say, I guarantee you that they would not be polluting their rivers, destroying their forests, you know, beyond repair. It's ludicrous. It is driven by distant autocratic powers, dictatorial, capitalist, heads of industries and other, you know, boards of corporations, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's beyond the pale. So it's all tied together. And, you know, the stuff that they're resisting in Eastern Europe with the IMF is the economic arm of the stuff that they're resisting in Iraq and Afghanistan, the military push of you know, our rule and domination for economic interests on behalf of global capital. You know, it's all tied together. So you have, you know, the IMF, G20, WTO, World Bank on one side, you know, pushing our economic, you know, neoliberal policies. And on the other side, you've got the Marines, the Air Force, the Army, you know, making sure that stuff right. is literally, you know, rammed home. And that's what you see in Afghanistan. That's what you see in Iraq. And that's why we're there.
Anyway, so I guess the show is coming to an end. We have about 2 minutes left. And, I guess I'd like to remind everyone that we're doing this show every day at 8 Eastern Time, 5 my time. I live on the West Coast. So please listen to the show, get involved, call in, get on the chat room. And hopefully we'll get Dave. Dave was doing this, co-hosting the show with me, and we're trying to get him to get back on the show, and just help us on this project.
And we can continue this conversation on the blog page as well.
90
right.
seconds.
So and if anybody has any questions for Joey, for me, for anybody who's hosting this show, send it in, and we'll try to answer it in the next show. So with that, I guess I'm going to say goodbye, and thank you, Joey, for being here. And I guess I'll play just to end another song of the Spanish Civil War, A las Barricadas. It's an anarchist Spanish Civil War song.
60
All right, folks.
Seconds.
Peace out.
Peace out.
10 seconds.